This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Willpower Instinct, How Self-Control Works, Why It Matters, and What You Can Do to Get More of It, by Kelly McGonigal. Read for you by Walter Dixon.
Introduction. Welcome to Willpower 101. Whenever I mention that I teach a course on willpower, the nearly universal response is, "Oh, that's what I need." Now more than ever, people realize that willpower, the ability to control their attention, emotions, and desires, influences their physical health, financial security, relationships, and professional success. We all know this. We know we're supposed to be in control of every aspect of our lives, from what we eat to what we do, say, and buy. And yet, most people feel like willpower failures. In control one moment, but overwhelmed and out of control the next. According to the American Psychological Association, Americans name lack of willpower as the number one reason they struggle to meet their goals. Many feel guilty about letting themselves and others down. Others feel at the mercy of their thoughts, emotions, and cravings, their lives dictated by impulses rather than conscious choices. Even the best controlled feel a kind of exhaustion at keeping it all together and wonder if life is supposed to be such a struggle. As a health psychologist and educator for the Stanford School of Medicine's Health Improvement Program, my job is to help people manage stress and make healthy choices. After years of watching people struggle to change their thoughts, emotions, bodies, and habits, I realized that much of what people believed about willpower was sabotaging their success and creating unnecessary stress. Although scientific research had much to say that could help them, it was clear that these insights had not yet become part of public understanding. Instead, people continued to rely on worn-out strategies for self-control. I saw again and again that the strategies most people used weren't just ineffective, they actually backfired, leading to self-sabotage and losing control. This led me to create The Science of Willpower, a class offered to the public through Stanford University's Continuing Studies program. The course brings together the newest insights about self-control from psychology, economics, neuroscience, and medicine to explain how we can break old habits and create healthy habits, conquer procrastination, find our focus, and manage stress. It illuminates why we give in to temptation and how we can find the strength to resist. It demonstrates the importance of understanding the limits of self-control and presents the best strategies for training willpower. To my delight, The Science of Willpower quickly became one of the most popular courses ever offered by Stanford Continuing Studies. The first time the course was offered, we had to move the room 4 times to accommodate the constantly growing enrollment. Corporate executives, teachers, athletes, healthcare professionals, and others curious about willpower filled one of the largest lecture halls at Stanford. Students started bringing their spouses, children, and co-workers to class so they could share the experience. I had hoped the course would be useful to this diverse group, who came to the class with goals ranging from quitting smoking and losing weight to getting out of debt and becoming a better parent. But even I was surprised by the results. A class survey 4 weeks into the course found that 97% of students felt they better understood their own behavior, and 84% reported that the class strategies had already given them more willpower. By the end of the course, participants told stories of how they had overcome a 30-year addiction to sweets, finally filed their back taxes, stopped yelling at their children, stuck to an exercise program, and generally felt better about themselves and more in charge of their choices. Course evaluations called the class life-changing. The consensus of the students was clear. Understanding the science of willpower gave them strategies for developing self-control and greater strength to pursue what mattered most to them. The scientific insights were as useful for the recovering alcoholic as the email addict, and the self-control strategies helped people resist temptations as varied as chocolate, video games, shopping, and even a married coworker. Students used the class to help meet personal goals such as running a marathon, starting a business, and managing the stress of job loss, family conflict, and the dreaded Friday morning spelling test. That's what happens when moms start bringing their kids to class. Of course, as any honest teacher will tell you, I learned a lot from my students as well. They fell asleep when I droned on too long about the wonder of a scientific finding, but forgot to mention what it had to do with their willpower challenges. They were quick to let me know which strategies worked in the real world and which fell flat, something a laboratory study can never tell you. They put creative spins on weekly assignments and showed me new ways for turning abstract theories into useful rules for everyday life. This audiobook combines the best scientific insights and practical exercises from the course, using the latest research and the acquired wisdom of the hundreds of students who have taken the class. To succeed at self-control, you need to know how you fail. Most books on changing behavior, whether it's a new diet plan or a guide to financial freedom, will help you set goals and even tell you what to do to reach them. But if identifying what we wanted to change were sufficient, every New Year's resolution would be a success, and my classroom would be empty. Few books will help you see why you aren't already doing these things, despite knowing full well that you need to do them. I believe that the best way to improve your self-control is to see how and why you lose control. Knowing you are likely to give in doesn't, as many people fear, set yourself up for failure. It allows you to support yourself and avoid the traps that lead to willpower failures. Research shows that people who think they have the most willpower are actually the most likely to lose control when tempted. For example, smokers who are the most optimistic about their ability to resist temptation are the most likely to relapse 4 months later, and over-optimistic dieters are the least likely to lose weight. Why? They fail to predict when, where, and why they will give in. They expose themselves to more temptation, such as hanging out with smokers or leaving cookies around the house. They're also most likely to be surprised by setbacks and give up on their goals when they run into difficulty. Self-knowledge, especially of how we find ourselves in willpower trouble, is the foundation of self-control. This is why both the Science of Willpower course and this audiobook focus on the most common willpower mistakes we all make. Each chapter dispels a common misconception about self-control and gives you a new way to think about your willpower challenges. For every willpower mistake, we'll conduct a kind of autopsy. When we give in to temptation or put off what we know we should do, what leads to our downfall? What is the fatal error, and why do we make it? Most important, we will look for the opportunity to save our future selves from this fate. How can we turn the knowledge of how we fail into strategies for success? At the very least, by the time you finish the audiobook, you will have a better understanding of your own imperfect but perfectly human behavior. One thing the Science of Willpower makes clear is that everyone struggles in some way with temptation, addiction, distraction, and procrastination. These are not individual weaknesses that reveal our personal inadequacies. They are universal experiences and part of the human condition. If this audiobook did nothing else but help you see the common humanity of your willpower struggles, I would be happy. But I hope that it will do far more, and that the strategies in this audiobook will empower you to make real and lasting changes in your life. How to use this audio program. Become a willpower scientist. I'm a scientist by training, and one of the very first things I learned is that while theories are nice, data is better. So, I'm going to ask you to treat this audiobook like an experiment. A scientific approach to self-control isn't limited to the laboratory. You can, and should, make yourself the subject of your own real-world study. As you listen to this audiobook, don't take my word for anything. After I've laid out the evidence for an idea, I'm going to ask you to test that idea in your own life. Collect your own data to find out what is true and what works for you. Within each chapter, you'll find two kinds of assignments to help you become a willpower scientist. The first I call Under the Microscope. These prompts ask you to pay attention to how an idea is already operating in your life. Before you can change something, you need to see it as it is. For example, I'll ask you to notice when you are most likely to give in to temptation or how hunger influences your spending. I'll invite you to pay attention to how you talk to yourself about your willpower challenges, including what you say to yourself when you procrastinate and how you judge your own willpower failures and successes. I'll even ask you to conduct some field studies, such as sleuthing out how retailers use store design to weaken your self-control. With each of these assignments, take the approach of a non-judgmental, curious observer, just like a scientist peering into a microscope, hoping to discover something fascinating and useful. These aren't opportunities to beat yourself up for every willpower weakness or to rail against the modern world for all its temptations. There is no place for the former, and I'll take care of the latter. You'll also find willpower experiments throughout each chapter. These are practical strategies for improving self-control based on a scientific study or theory. You can apply these willpower boosts immediately to real-life challenges. I encourage you to have an open mind about each strategy, even the ones that seem counterintuitive, and there will be plenty. They've been pilot-tested by students in my course, and while not every strategy works for everyone, these are the ones that earned the highest praise. The ones that sounded good in theory but embarrassingly flopped in real life, you won't find them in these chapters. These experiments are a great way to break out of a rut and find new solutions for old problems. I encourage you to try different strategies and collect your own data about which help you the most. Because they are experiments, not exams, you can't fail, even if you decide to try the exact opposite of what the science suggests. After all, science needs skeptics. Share the strategies with your friends, family, and colleagues, and see what works for them. You'll always learn something, and you can use what you've learned to refine your own strategies for self-control. Your Willpower Challenge. To get the most out of this audiobook, I recommend picking a specific willpower challenge to test every idea against. We all have willpower challenges. Some are universal. For example, thanks to our biological instinct to crave sugar and fat, we all need to restrain our urge to single-handedly keep the local bakery in business. But many of our willpower challenges are unique. What you crave, another person might be repulsed by. What you're addicted to, another person might find boring. And what you put off, another person might pay to do. Whatever the specifics, these challenges tend to play out in the same way for each of us. Your craving for chocolate is not so different from a smoker's craving for a cigarette or a shopaholic's craving to spend. How you talk yourself out of exercising is not so different from how someone else justifies not opening the past due bills and another person puts off studying for one more night. Your willpower challenge could be something you've been avoiding, what we'll call an I will power challenge, or a habit you want to break, an I won't power challenge. You could also choose an important goal in your life that you'd like to give more energy and focus to, an I want power challenge. Whether it's improving your health, managing stress, honing your parenting skills, or furthering your career. Because distraction, temptation, impulse control, and procrastination are such universal human challenges, the strategies in this audiobook will be helpful for any goal you choose. By the time you finish the audiobook, you'll have a greater insight into your challenges and a new set of self-control strategies to support you. Take your time. This audiobook is designed to be used as if you were taking my 10-week course. It's divided into 10 chapters, each of which describes one key idea, the science behind it, and how it can be applied to your goals. The ideas and strategies build on each other so that what you do in each chapter prepares you for the next. Although you could listen to this whole audio program in one weekend, I encourage you to pace yourself when it comes to implementing the strategies. Students in my class take an entire week to observe how each idea plays out in their own lives. They try one new strategy for self-control each week and report on what worked best. I recommend that you take a similar approach, especially if you plan to use this audiobook to tackle a specific goal, such as losing weight or getting control of your finances. Give yourself time to try out the practical exercises and reflect. Pick one strategy from each chapter, whichever seems relevant to your challenge, rather than trying out 10 new strategies at once. You can use the 10-week structure of the book anytime you want to make a change or achieve a goal, just as some students have taken the course multiple times, focusing on a different willpower challenge each time. But if you intend to listen to the whole audio program first, enjoy, and don't worry about trying to keep up with the reflections and exercises as you go. Make a note of the ones that seem most interesting to you, and return to them when you're ready to put the ideas into action. Let's begin. Here's your first assignment. Choose one of the challenges for our journey through the science of willpower. Then, meet me in Chapter 1, where we'll take a trip back in time to investigate where this thing called willpower comes from and how we can get more of it. Under the microscope, choose your willpower challenge. If you haven't already, now's the time to pick the willpower challenge to which you'd most like to apply the ideas and strategies in this audiobook. The following questions can help you identify the challenge you're ready to take on. I will power challenge. What is something that you would like to do more of, or stop putting off, because you know that doing it will improve the quality of your life? I won't power challenge. What is the stickiest habit in your life? What would you like to give up or do less of because it's undermining your health, happiness, or success? I want power challenge. What is the most important long-term goal you'd like to focus your energy on? What immediate want is most likely to distract you or tempt you away from this goal? Chapter 1. I will, I won't, I want. What willpower is and why it matters. When you think of something that requires willpower, what's the first thing that comes to mind? For most of us, the classic test of willpower is resisting temptation. Whether the temptress is a donut, a cigarette, a clearance sale, or a one-night stand. When people say, "I have no willpower," what they really mean is, "I have trouble saying no when my mouth, stomach, heart, or fill in your anatomical part, wants to say yes." Think of it as, "I won't power." But saying no is just one part of what willpower is and what it requires. After all, "just say no" are the three favorite words of procrastinators and couch potatoes worldwide. At times, it's more important to say yes. All those things you put off for tomorrow or forever, willpower helps you put them on today's to-do list, even when anxiety, distractions, or a reality TV show marathon threaten to talk you out of it. Think of it as I will power, the ability to do what you need to do, even if a part of you doesn't want to. I will and I won't power are the two sides of self-control, but they alone don't constitute willpower. To say no when you need to say no, and yes when you need to say yes, you need a third power, the ability to remember what you really want. I know, you think that what you really want is the brownie, the third martini, or the day off. But when you're facing temptation or flirting with procrastination, you need to remember that what you really want is to fit into your skinny jeans, get the promotion, get out of credit card debt, stay in your marriage, or stay out of jail. Otherwise, what's going to stop you from following your immediate desires? To exert self-control, you need to find your motivation when it matters. This is I want power. Willpower is about harnessing the three powers of I will, I won't, and I want to help you achieve your goals and stay out of trouble. As we'll see, we human beings are the fortunate recipients of brains that support all of these capacities. In fact, the development of these three powers, I will, I won't, and I want, may define what it means to be human. Before we get down to the dirty business of analyzing why we fail to use these powers, let's begin by appreciating how lucky we are to have them. We'll take a quick peek into the brain to see where the magic happens, and discover how we can train the brain to have more willpower. We'll also take our first look at why willpower can be hard to find, and how to use another uniquely human trait, self-awareness, to avoid willpower failure. Why we have willpower. Imagine this. It is 100,000 years ago, and you are a top-of-the-line Homo sapiens of the most recently evolved variety. Yes, take a moment to get excited about your opposable thumbs, erect spine, and hyoid bone, which allows you to produce some kind of speech, though I'll be damned if I know what it sounds like. Congratulations, too, on your ability to use fire without setting yourself on fire, and your skill at carving up buffalo and hippos with your cutting-edge stone tools. Just a few generations ago, your responsibilities in life would have been so simple. 1. Find dinner. 2. Reproduce. 3. Avoid unexpected encounters with a Crocodylus anthropophagus. That's Latin for crocodile that snacks on humans. But you live in a closely knit tribe and depend on other Homo sapiens for your survival. That means you have to add not piss anyone off in the process to your list of priorities. Communities require cooperation and sharing resources. You can't just take what you want. Stealing someone else's buffalo burger or mate could get you exiled from the group or even killed. Remember, other Homo sapiens have sharp stone tools too, and your skin is a lot thinner than a hippo's. Moreover, you might need your tribe to care for you if you get sick or injured. No more hunting and gathering for you. Even in the Stone Age, the rules for how to win friends and influence people were likely the same as today's. Cooperate when your neighbor needs shelter. Share your dinner, even if you're still hungry. And think twice before saying, "That loincloth makes you look fat." In other words, a little self-control, please. It's not just your life that's on the line. The whole tribe's survival depends on your ability to be more selective about whom you fight with. Keep it out of the clan. And whom you mate with. Not a first cousin, please. You need to increase genetic diversity so that your whole tribe isn't wiped out by one disease. And if you're lucky enough to find a mate, you're now expected to bond for life, not just frolic once behind a bush. Yes, for you, the almost modern human, there are all sorts of new ways to get into trouble with the time-tested instincts of appetite, aggression, and sex. This was just the beginning of the need for what we now call willpower. As prehistory marched on, the increasing complexity of our social worlds required a matching increase in self-control. The need to fit in, cooperate, and maintain long-term relationships put pressure on our early human brains to develop strategies for self-control. Who we are now is a response to these demands. Our brains caught up, and voila, we have willpower. The ability to control the impulses that helped us become fully human. Why it matters now. Back to modern day life. You can keep your opposable thumbs, of course, though you may want to put on a little more clothing. Willpower has gone from being the thing that distinguishes us humans from other animals to the thing that distinguishes us from each other. We may all have been born with the capacity for willpower, but some of us use it more than others. People who have better control of their attention, emotions, and actions are better off almost any way you look at it. They are happier and healthier. Their relationships are more satisfying and last longer. They make more money and go further in their careers. They are better able to manage stress, deal with conflict, and overcome adversity. They even live longer. When pit against other virtues, willpower comes out on top. Self-control is a better predictor of academic success than intelligence. Take that, SATs. A stronger determinant of effective leadership than charisma. Sorry, Tony Robbins. And more important for marital bliss than empathy. Yes, the secret to lasting marriage may be learning how to keep your mouth shut. If we want to improve our lives, willpower is not a bad place to start. To do this, we're going to have to ask a little more of our standard-equipped brains. And so, let's start by taking a look at what it is we're working with. The neuroscience of I will, I won't, and I want. Our modern powers of self-control are the product of long-ago pressures to be better neighbors, parents, and mates. But how exactly did the human brain catch up? The answer appears to be the development of the prefrontal cortex, a nice chunk of neural real estate right behind your forehead and eyes. For most of evolutionary history, the prefrontal cortex mainly controlled physical movement, walking, running, reaching, pushing, a kind of proto-self-control. As humans evolved, the prefrontal cortex got bigger and better connected to the other areas of the brain. It now takes up a larger portion of the human brain than the brains of other species, one reason you'll never see your dog saving kibble for retirement. As the prefrontal cortex grew, it took on new control functions, controlling what you pay attention to, what you think about, even how you feel. This made it even better at controlling what you do. Robert Saplowski, a neurobiologist at Stanford University, has argued that the main job of the modern prefrontal cortex is to bias the brain, and therefore you, toward doing the harder thing. When it's easier to stay on the couch, your prefrontal cortex makes you want to get up and exercise. When it's easier to say yes to dessert, your prefrontal cortex remembers the reasons for ordering tea instead. And when it's easier to put that project off until tomorrow, it's your prefrontal cortex that helps you open the file and make progress anyway. The prefrontal cortex is not one unified blob of gray matter. It has three key regions that divvy up the jobs of I will, I won't, and I want. One region, near the upper left side of the prefrontal cortex, specializes in I will power. It helps you start and stick to boring, difficult, or stressful tasks, like staying on the treadmill when you'd rather hit the shower. The right side, in contrast, handles I won't power, holding you back from following every impulse or craving. You can thank this region for the last time you were tempted to read a text message while driving but kept your eyes on the road instead. Together, these two areas control what you do. The third region, just a bit lower and in the middle of the prefrontal cortex, keeps track of your goals and your desires. It decides what you want. The more rapidly it cells fire, the more motivated you are to take action or resist temptation. This part of the prefrontal cortex remembers what you really want, even when the rest of your brain is screaming, "Eat that! Drink that! Smoke that! Buy that!" Under the microscope, what is the harder thing? Every willpower challenge requires doing something difficult, whether it's walking away from temptation or not running away from a stressful situation. Imagine yourself facing your specific willpower challenge. What is the harder thing? What makes it so difficult? How do you feel when you think about doing it? A mind-blowing case of willpower lost. How important is the prefrontal cortex for self-control? One way to answer that question is to look at what happens when you lose it. The most famous case of prefrontal cortex brain damage is the story of Phineas Gage. And fair warning, this is a gory story. You might want to put down your sandwich. In 1848, Phineas Gage was a 25-year-old foreman for a gang of rail workers. His employers called him their best foreman, and his team respected and liked him. His friends and family called him quiet and respectful. His physician, John Martin Harlow, described him as exceptionally strong in both mind and body, possessing an iron will and an iron frame. But all that changed on Wednesday, September 13th, at 4:30 p.m. Gage and his men were using explosives to clear a path through Vermont for the Rutland and Burlington Railroad. Gage's job was to set up each explosion. This procedure had gone right 1,000 times, and yet this time, something went wrong. The explosion happened too soon, and the blast sent a 3-foot, 7-inch tamping iron straight into Gage's skull. It pierced his left cheek, blew through his prefrontal cortex, and landed 30 yards behind him, carrying some of Gage's gray matter with it. You might now be picturing Gage, flat on his back, instantly killed. But he didn't die. By witness reports, he didn't even pass out. Instead, his workers put him in an ox cart and pushed him almost a mile back to the tavern where he was staying. His physician patched him up as well as possible, replacing the largest fragments of skull recovered from the accident site and stretching the scalp to cover the wounds. Gage's full physical recovery took over 2 months, set back perhaps as much by Dr. Harlow's enthusiasm for prescribing enemas as by the persistent fungus growing out of Gage's exposed brain. But by November 17th, he was sufficiently healed to return to his regular life. Gage himself reported, feeling better in every respect, with no lingering pain. Sounds like a happy ending. But unfortunately for Gage, the story doesn't end there. His outer wounds may have healed, but something strange was happening inside Gage's brain. According to his friends and co-workers, his personality had changed. Dr. Harlow described the changes in a follow-up to his original medical report of the accident. The balance between his intellectual faculties and his animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. He is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom, manifesting but little deference for his fellows, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, devising many plans of future operation which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned. In this regard, his mind was radically changed, so decidedly that his friends and acquaintances said he was no longer Gage. In other words, when Gage lost his prefrontal cortex, he lost his willpower, his won't power, and his want power. His iron will, something that had seemed like an unshakable part of his character, had been destroyed by the tamping iron that blew through his skull. Most of us don't have to worry about ill-timed railroad explosions robbing us of our self-control, but we all have a little Phineas Gage in us. The prefrontal cortex is not always as reliable as we'd like. Many temporary states, like being drunk, sleep-deprived, or even just distracted, inhibit the prefrontal cortex, mimicking the brain damage that Gage sustained. This leaves us less able to control our impulses, even though our gray matter is still safe in our skulls. Even when our brains are well rested and sober, we aren't fully out of danger. That's because while we all have the capacity to do the harder thing, we also have the desire to do exactly the opposite. This impulse needs to be restrained, and as we'll see, it often has a mind of its own. The problem of two minds. When we watch our willpower fail, spending too much, eating too much, wasting time, and losing our tempers, well, it can make a person wonder if he has a prefrontal cortex at all. Sure, it might be possible to resist temptation, but that doesn't guarantee that we will. It's conceivable that we could do today what begs to be done tomorrow, but more often than not, tomorrow wins. For this frustrating fact of life, you can also give evolution a big thanks. As humans evolved, our brains didn't so much change as they grew. Evolution prefers to add on to what it's created, rather than start from scratch. So, as humans required new skills, our primitive brain was not replaced with some completely new model. The system of self-control was slapped on top of that old system of urges and instincts. That means that for any instinct that once served us well, evolution has kept it around, even if it now gets us into trouble. The good news is, evolution has also given us a way to handle the problems we run into. Take, for example, our taste buds' delight in the foods most likely to make us fat. An insatiable sweet tooth once helped humans survive when food was scarce and extra body fat was life insurance. Fast forward to our modern environment of fast food, junk food, and whole foods, and there is more than enough to go around. Extra weight has become a health risk, not an insurance policy, and the ability to resist tempting foods is more important for long-term survival. But because it paid off for our ancestors, our modern brains still come equipped with a well-preserved instinct to crave fat and sweets. Fortunately, we can use the brain's more recently evolved self-control system to override those cravings and keep our hands out of the candy bowl. So, while we're stuck with the impulse, we're also equipped with the impulse control. Some neuroscientists go so far as to say that we have one brain, but two minds, or even two people living inside our mind. There's the version of us that acts on impulse and seeks immediate gratification, and the version of us that controls our impulses and delays gratification to protect our long-term goals. They're both us, but we switch back and forth between these two selves. Sometimes we identify with the person who wants to lose weight, and sometimes we identify with the person who just wants the cookie. This is what defines a willpower challenge. Part of you wants one thing, and another part of you wants something else. Or your present self wants one thing, but your future self would be better off if you did something else. When these two selves disagree, one version of us has to override the other. The part of you that wants to give in isn't bad. It simply has a different point of view about what matters most. Under the microscope, meet your two minds. Every willpower challenge is a conflict between two parts of oneself. For your own willpower challenge, describe these competing minds. What does the impulse version of you want? What does the wiser version of you want? Some people find it useful to give a name to the impulsive mind, like the cookie monster, to the part of you that always wants instant gratification, the critic, to the part of you that likes to complain about everyone and everything, or the procrastinator, to the person who never wants to get started. Giving a name to this version of yourself can help you recognize when it is taking over and also help you call in your wiser self for some willpower support. The value of both selves. It's tempting to think about the self-control system as being the infinitely superior self and our more primitive instincts as an embarrassing vestige of our evolutionary past. Sure, back when our knuckles dragged in the dirt, those instincts helped us survive long enough to pass on our genes, but now they just get in the way, leading to health problems, empty bank accounts, and sexual encounters we have to apologize for on national television. If only we civilized creatures weren't still burdened with the desires of our long-ago ancestors. Not so fast. Though our survival system doesn't always work to our advantage, it is a mistake to think we should conquer the primitive self completely. Medical case studies of people who have lost these instincts through brain damage reveal how critical our primitive fears and desires are for health, happiness, and even self-control. One of the strangest cases involved a young woman who had part of her midbrain destroyed during a brain surgery to stop seizures. She appeared to lose the ability to feel fear and disgust, which robbed her of two of the most instinctive sources of self-restraint. She developed a habit of stuffing herself with food until she got sick and could frequently be found sexually propositioning family members, not exactly a model of self-control. As we'll see throughout this audiobook, without desires, we'd become depressed, and without fear, we'd fail to protect ourselves from future danger. Part of succeeding at your willpower challenges will be finding a way to take advantage of and not fight such primitive instincts. Neuroeconomists, scientists who study what the brain does when we make decisions, have discovered that the self-control system and our survival instincts don't always conflict. In some cases, they cooperate to help us make good decisions. For example, imagine that you're walking through a department store and something shiny catches your eye. Your primitive brain shrieks, "Buy it!" Then you check out the price tag, $199.99. Before you saw the outrageous price, you would have needed some serious prefrontal cortex intervention to shut down the spending impulse. But what if your brain registers an instinctive pain response to the price? Studies show that this actually happens. The brain can treat a hefty price tag like a physical punch to the gut. That instinctive shock is going to make the job easy for your prefrontal cortex, and you'll barely need to exert any "I won't" power. As we aim to improve our willpower, we'll look for ways to use every bit of what it means to be human, including our most primitive instincts, from the desire for pleasure to the need to fit in, to support our goals. The first rule of willpower: know thyself. Self-control is one of mankind's most fabulous upgrades, but it's not our only distinction. We also possess self-awareness, the ability to realize what we are doing as we do it and understand why we are doing it. With any luck, we can also predict what we're likely to do before we're doing it, giving us ample opportunity to reconsider. This level of self-awareness appears to be uniquely human. Sure, dolphins and elephants can recognize themselves in a mirror, but there's little evidence that they search their souls for self-understanding. Without self-awareness, the self-control system would be useless. You need to recognize when you're making a choice that requires willpower. Otherwise, the brain always defaults to what is easiest. Consider a smoker who wants to quit. She needs to recognize the first sign of a craving and where it's likely to lead her, outside in the cold, fumbling with a lighter. She also needs to recognize that if she gives in to the craving this time, she's more likely to smoke again tomorrow. One more look in the crystal ball, and she'll see that if she continues on this path, she'll end up with all those horrible diseases she learned about in health class. To avoid this fate, she needs to make a conscious choice not to smoke the cigarette. Without self-awareness, she's doomed. This may sound simple, but psychologists know that most of our choices are made on autopilot, without any real awareness of what's driving them, and certainly without serious reflection on their consequences. Heck, most of the time, we don't even realize we're making a choice. For example, one study asked people how many food-related decisions they made in one day. What would you say? On average, people guessed 14. In reality, when these same folks carefully tracked their decisions, the average was 227. That's more than 200 choices people were initially unaware of, and those are just the decisions related to eating. How can you control yourself if you aren't even aware that there is something to control? Modern society, with its constant distractions and stimulation, doesn't help. Baba Shiv, a professor of marketing at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, has shown that people who are distracted are more likely to give in to temptations. For example, students trying to remember a telephone number are 50% more likely to choose chocolate cake over fruit at a snack cart. Distracted shoppers are more susceptible to in-store promotions and more likely to go home with items not on their shopping lists. When your mind is preoccupied, your impulses, not your long-term goals, will guide your choices. Texting as you stand in line waiting to order at the coffee shop? You might just find yourself asking for a mocha milkshake instead of an iced coffee. Incoming text message? Bet you don't want to know how many calories are in that drink. Can't get your mind off work? You might just find yourself agreeing with the salesperson that you need the upgrade and unlimited service package. Willpower experiment. Track your willpower choices. To have more self-control, you first need to develop more self-awareness. A good first step is to notice when you are making choices related to your willpower challenge. Some will be more obvious, such as, do I go to the gym after work? The impact of other decisions might not be clear until later in the day when you see their full consequences. For example, did you choose to pack your gym bag so you wouldn't have to go home first? Smart. You'll be less likely to make excuses. Did you get caught up in a phone call until you were too hungry to go straight to the gym? Oops. You'll be less likely to exercise if you have to stop for dinner first. For at least one day, track your choices. At the end of the day, look back and try to analyze when decisions were made that either supported or undermined your goals. Trying to keep track of your choices will also reduce the number of decisions you make while distracted, a guaranteed way to boost your willpower. An email addict takes the first step to recovery. Michelle, a 31-year-old radio show producer, was constantly checking email on her computer or her phone. It was disrupting her productivity at work and annoying her boyfriend, who could never manage to get Michelle's full attention. Her willpower challenge for the class was to check email less, and she set an ambitious goal of checking no more than once an hour. After the first week, she reported that she did not even come close to her goal. The problem was that she often didn't realize that she was checking her email until after she was scrolling through new messages. She could stop once she realized what she was doing. But whatever impulse led her to look at her phone or click over her email was happening outside of conscious awareness. Michelle set the goal to catch herself sooner in the process. By the next week, she was able to notice when she was reaching for her phone or opening her email. That gave her an opportunity to practice stopping before she got fully sucked in. The impulse to check was more elusive. Michelle had trouble recognizing what was prompting her to check before she was in the process of checking. With time, though, she came to recognize a feeling almost like an itch, a tension in her brain and body that was relieved when she checked her email. That observation was fascinating to Michelle. She had never thought of checking email as a way to relieve tension. She had thought she was just seeking information. As she paid attention to how she felt after she checked, Michelle realized that checking her email was as ineffective as scratching an itch. It just made her itch more. With this awareness of both the impulse and her response, she had much more control over her behavior and even surpassed her original goal to check less often outside of work hours. This week, commit to watching how the process of giving in to your impulses happens. You don't even need to set a goal to improve your self-control yet. See if you can catch yourself earlier and earlier in the process, noticing what thoughts, feelings, and situations are most likely to prompt the impulse. What do you think or say to yourself that makes it more likely that you will give in? Train your brain for willpower. It took evolution millions of years to deliver a prefrontal cortex that is capable of everything we humans need, so perhaps it's a little greedy to ask this. But is it possible to make our brains even better at self-control without having to hang around for another million? If a basic human brain is pretty good at self-control, is there anything we can do right now to improve on the standard model? Since the dawn of time, or at least since researchers started poking and prodding the human brain, it was assumed that the brain was fixed in structure. Whatever brain power you had was a done deal, not a work in progress. The only change your brain was going to see was the deterioration of getting old. But over the last decade, neuroscientists have discovered that, like an eager student, the brain is remarkably responsive to experience. Ask your brain to do math every day, and it gets better at math. Ask your brain to worry, and it gets better at worrying. Ask your brain to concentrate, and it gets better at concentrating. Not only does your brain find these things easier, but it actually remodels itself based on what you ask it to do. Some parts of the brain grow denser, packing in more and more gray matter like a muscle bulking up from exercise. For example, adults who learn how to juggle develop more gray matter in regions of the brain that track moving objects. Areas of the brain can also grow more connected to each other, so they can share information more quickly. For example, adults who play memory games for 25 minutes a day develop greater connectivity between brain regions important for attention and memory. But brain training isn't just for juggling and remembering where you left your glasses. There is growing scientific evidence that you can train your brain to get better at self-control. What does willpower training for your brain look like? Well, you could challenge your "I won't" power by planting temptation traps around your home, a chocolate bar in your sock drawer, a martini station by your exercise bike, the photo of your very married high school sweetheart taped to the fridge. Or you could build your own "I will" power obstacle course with stations that require you to drink wheatgrass juice, do 20 jumping jacks, and file your taxes early. Or you could do something a lot simpler and less painful. Meditate. Neuroscientists have discovered that when you ask the brain to meditate, it gets better not just at meditating, but at a wide range of self-control skills, including attention, focus, stress management, impulse control, and self-awareness. People who meditate regularly aren't just better at these things. Over time, their brains become finely tuned willpower machines. Regular meditators have more gray matter in the prefrontal cortex, as well as regions of the brain that support self-awareness. It doesn't take a lifetime of meditation to change the brain. Some researchers have started to look for the smallest dose of meditation needed to see benefits, an approach my students deeply appreciate since not many are going to head off to the Himalayas to sit in a cave for the next decade. These studies take people who have never meditated before, even folks who are skeptical of the whole thing, and teach them a simple meditation technique like the one you'll learn just ahead. One study found that just 3 hours of meditation practice led to improved attention and self-control. After 11 hours, researchers could see those changes in the brain. The new meditators had increased neural connections between regions of the brain important for staying focused ignoring distractions, and controlling impulses. Another study found that 8 weeks of daily meditation practice led to increased self-awareness in everyday life, as well as increased gray matter in corresponding areas of the brain. It may seem incredible that our brains can reshape themselves so quickly, but meditation increases blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, in much the same way that lifting weights increases blood flow to your muscles. The brain appears to adapt to exercise in the same way that muscles do, getting both bigger and faster in order to get better at what you ask of it. So, if you're ready to train your brain, the following meditation technique will get the blood rushing to your prefrontal cortex, the closest we can get to speeding up evolution and making the most of our brain's potential. Willpower Experiment, a 5-minute brain training meditation. Breath focus is a simple but powerful meditation technique for training your brain and increasing willpower. It reduces stress and teaches the mind how to handle both inner distractions, cravings, worries, desires, and outer temptations, sounds, sights, and smells. New research shows that regular meditation practice helps people quit smoking, lose weight, kick a drug habit, and stay sober. Whatever your I will and I won't challenges are, this 5-minute meditation is a powerful brain training exercise for boosting your willpower. Here's how to get started. 1. Sit still and stay put. Sit in a chair with your feet flat on the ground, or sit cross-legged on a cushion. Sit up straight and rest your hands in your lap. It's important not to fidget when you meditate. That's the physical foundation of self-control. If you notice the instinct to scratch an itch, adjust your arms or cross and uncross your legs. See if you can feel the urge, but not follow it. This simple act of staying still is part of what makes meditation willpower training effective. You're learning not to automatically follow every single impulse that your brain and body produce. 2. Turn your attention to the breath. Close your eyes, or if you are worried about falling asleep, focus your gaze at a single spot, like a blank wall, not the home shopping network. Be sure to notice your breathing. Silently say in your mind, inhale as you breathe in and exhale as you breathe out. When you notice your mind wandering, and it will, just bring it back to the breath. This practice of coming back to the breath again and again kicks the prefrontal cortex into high gear and quiets the stress and craving centers of your brain. 3. Notice how it feels to breathe, and notice how the mind wanders. After a few minutes, drop the labels inhale, exhale. Try focusing on just the feeling of breathing. You might notice the sensations of the breath flowing in and out of your nose and mouth. You might sense the belly or chest expanding as you breathe in and deflating as you breathe out. Your mind might wander a bit more without the labeling. Just as before, when you notice yourself thinking about something else, bring your attention back to the breath. If you need help refocusing, bring yourself back to the breath by saying inhale and exhale for a few rounds. This part of the practice trains self-awareness along with self-control. Start with 5 minutes a day. When this becomes a habit, try 10 to 15 minutes a day. If that starts to feel like a burden, bring it back down to 5. A short practice that you do every day is better than a long practice you keep putting off to tomorrow. It may help you to pick a specific time that you will meditate every day, like right before your morning shower. If this is impossible, staying flexible will help you fit it in when you can. Being bad at meditation is good for self-control. Andrew felt like a terrible meditator. The 51-year-old electrical engineer was convinced that the goal of meditation was to get rid of all thoughts and empty the mind. Even when he was focused on his breath, other thoughts sneaked in. He was ready to give up on the practice because he wasn't getting better at it as quickly as he hoped, and figured he was wasting his time if he wasn't able to focus perfectly on the breath. Most new meditators make this mistake, but the truth is that being bad at meditation is exactly what makes the practice effective. I encouraged Andrew and all the other frustrated meditators in class to pay attention not just to how well they were focusing during the meditation, but how it was affecting their focus and choices during the rest of the day. Andrew found that even when his meditation felt distracted, he was more focused after practicing than if he skipped it. He also realized that what he was doing in meditation was exactly what he needed to do in real life. Catch himself moving away from a goal and then point himself back at the goal. In this case, focusing on the breath. The meditation was perfect practice.